Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and today we are looking at two things. Firstly, we are covering an extraordinary miscarriage of justice at the post office that has been two full decades in the making. We'll be talking about that in a moment. Later on, we'll also be talking about Private Eye's royal coverage over the years. I'll be speaking to the magazine's editor, Ian Hislop, to Nick Newman, and also to Adam McQueen, who is the handler of the mysterious Flunky, the Eye's royal correspondent with friends in extremely high places. But firstly, the post office. In 2010, Seema Misra, a sub-postmaster in West Byfleet in Surrey, was found guilty in court and sentenced to 15 months in prison for stealing £78,000 from the post office that she ran. She was sent to prison while pregnant. She had to give birth to her second child in hospital while wearing a tag. Misra had pled not guilty in court, and there was a very good reason for that, which is that the money that she appeared to have stolen had actually gone missing from the accounts of the post office she ran due to a computer glitch. A computer glitch that was not an isolated incident. In fact, due to the post office's faulty technological systems, 550 separate sub-postmasters across the country have had their lives, their careers, and their finances ruined, and some, like Seema Misra, have even been prosecuted due to it. To find out a little more, I spoke to Richard Brooks and to Nick Wallace. They've been covering the story for the magazine, and they are preparing a special report about the extraordinary saga, which is going to be running in the magazine in a couple of months' time. I started off by asking Nick Wallace just how the story had come to his attention in the first place.
Yeah, I got involved through Seema Misra's husband, who called me up while I was a breakfast show presenter for a BBC local radio station, saying his pregnant wife had been sent to prison for a crime she didn't commit. And obviously, you don't get stories like that falling into your lap every day. So I did some work on it and found there was quite a bit of information in the public domain about other sub-postmasters who'd had problems. And I think there'd been a Welsh language broadcast called Taro Now by S4C, using some BBC journalists who'd found around 30 people, most of whom were in Wales, who'd had problems with the Horizon computer system. So this clearly meant that there was something going on. I think by that stage, this was back in 2010, the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance was in its early days, and that was run by a chap called Alan Bates, who is a key figure in this story. He was a sub-postmaster back in North Wales in the early 2000s.
Okay, so just to break in here with a little quick definition of terms for any listeners not up on their post office terminology. Sub-postmaster, what's going on there? What's that?
Well, sub-postmasters go back hundreds of years. They run smaller post offices outside the big city centres. And they were there to collect the post that was being delivered around the country. And as the post office grew, they acquired much bigger roles, things like paying benefits, selling licenses, dog licenses, driving licenses, that kind of thing. And they became important parts of the community across the country.
And they were asked to install this new system.
They were told to install the new system.
Told, and this is Horizon.
It was rolled out compulsorily.
Okay.
And just to give you an idea of the scale of this system, I've been told it's the largest non-military computer system in Europe.
Wow.
At the time Horizon was rolled out, there were 18,000 post office branches. And if you imagine you go into a reasonably busy branch post office in a town, you might see four or five counters. So each of these counters would have a Horizon terminal in the branch. So if there's five Horizon terminals per branch, multiplied by 18,000, you've got a lot of hardware being rolled out. Or over the course of a year and a half. It didn't take very long before it happened.
Well, I mean, the history of Horizon is pretty interesting, and it's really why I think it was of such interest to Private Eye when we picked up on this story, because it was one of these. It started life as one of these mega government IT projects back in the 90s. Governments thought that, you know, there was no public service that couldn't be improved by chucking billions at a new IT system. It was originally set up in 1996 as a private finance initiative contract to transform the payment of benefits through a benefit card system. But that didn't work. it all fell apart, partly because of the software.
It was hilarious, wasn't it? Basically, the people putting together this system had two clients, the post office and the DWP, who both wanted different things. I mean, it's a classic government procurement cock-up story. And I think over £1.5 billion was wasted
It cost the post office £570 million down the tubes.
This is 90s money as well. This is a lot.
The government was faced with, you know, what to do with this botched IT system.
Okay.
And in 1999, it decided to try to make the best of a bad job. So it said, well, we'll scrap the benefits payments through this system, but we will roll out the whole system to run the financial and accounting system and payment systems across the post office network.
Okay. So that's now the principal use of this Horizon software. Postmasters and subpostmasters have to install it on pain of what, losing their jobs?
It was compulsory. Post office is a very didactic organization in the way it has a relationship with its subpostmasters. What they say goes. That's the deal.
And these places are run kind of in a way like franchises.
Exactly that. Yeah.
So do they apply to be a subpostmaster?
If you are looking around to run a post office because you think that's a guaranteed income and it gives me footfall on my retail business, then you see who's selling. That person will then tell the post office that you are looking to become a subpostmaster. The post office will ask you to apply for the job. There may be other applicants. When they have selected who they think is appropriate to be a sub-postmaster, they will then go back to the vendor and say, right, you can choose the next sub-postmaster from one of these three, depending on what offer they make for the rest of your business. Does this make sense?
When you say the rest of the business?
The retail side of the business. So you've got the post office side of the business, which is owned by the post office, and you are paid a salary, or you used to be paid a salary to be the sub-postmaster.
And then you've got the shop that comes with it.
Yeah. And you are chosen by the post office to be a sub-postmaster. Yeah. The retail business is down to the deal that you cut with the outgoing vendor.
So this is much more than just getting a job that you might be fired from. This is people investing a large proportion of their livelihood and their money in it.
Yep, and their reputation, everything.
So at what point do problems start to emerge for these sub-postmasters?
Immediately.
Okay.
This is a very complex computer system, and for most of its history, it's worked okay for the people who use it. The problem is what happens when things go wrong. And right from the very start, people were having glitches, errors, bugs, discrepancies, which would show up on their computer screens, which they would be forced under their contract to accept. But they could appeal to a helpline and say, look, you know, I don't know what's going on my computer here, but it's telling me that I'm 400 quid, 500 quid, 2 grand out of whack. What do I do to fix it? And they would be offered advice. But at the end of the day, if the advice did not work, they would be held liable for the discrepancy.
Okay, so if you're taking some money at the counter of the post office, you sell some stamps for £5, and the computer says, well, you should have taken £500 there, that's suddenly £495 that you are out of pocket. And if the advice doesn't work, you're on the hook for that.
Exactly that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a problem.
What we found is that, going right back to the start of this program, the post office knew there were these problems. There's a board minute from 1999 in which the post office board are recording software problems with this new IT system. But that message wasn't allowed to get through to the front line, to the people who investigated shortfalls in branches. So they weren't really allowed to entertain the fact that there could be problems caused by the IT system. They said that, no, it can't be the IT system. It must be you, the sub-postmaster, stealing the money.
Because it was easier for them to do that. Under the terms of the contract, it was easier for them to go after their sub-postmasters to make good any discrepancies than it was to go back to Fujitsu, who ran the computer system, and pay for them to investigate.
There's an incentive for the people running the post office to say, well, this is clearly the work of errant sub-postmasters. But surely there had not been hundreds of cases a year of sub-postmasters stealing money before now. Surely there was a massive spike in the figures of inexplicable discrepancies in the till.
The issue really was that they saw this new system as a way of identifying where there was certainly fraud. Before, you had paper-based systems generally, or sub-post offices operating their own system, which the post office investigators couldn't assume were 100% reliable. Mm. Now they had a system which they thought they could assume was 100% reliable, and therefore if there was a shortfall, it wasn't the computer, it was the postmaster.
So they saw these, what we now know were errors, cropping up in the system, but they had so much faith in the computers that they assumed, well, the computers are right, so it's clearly the people who are wrong.
Yeah, and they thought, wow, we're now uncovering all this fraud that's going on. We're finding it, whereas before we didn't find it.
Who is running the post office at this point?
It's a government-owned business.
Yeah.
It's still the only shareholder is the government. So by that stage, you had what was known as Post Office Counters Limited, POCL, which then became Post Office Limited in the mid-2000s. But essentially, it was a board of directors run as a limited company, as an arm's-length body from its sole shareholder, the government.
Okay.
Because ultimately, the ministers are in control of this organisation.
But the interesting thing was that it was changing. This was in the late 1990s. It was becoming increasingly commercialised, increasingly profit-driven.
Okay.
There were financial problems. The government itself had financial difficulties in the late 1990s. It was trying to extract more money in the form of dividends from the post office. So there was a lot of pressure financially on the post office. And in that environment, they were pretty keen to root out theft.
Yeah.
And not accept that they had their own problem.
Okay. So this system is in place and going wrong. At what point did the old Bill start getting involved? At what point does the post office phone the police?
That's a very good question, Andrew. Yeah. You take this, Richard.
Yeah, the old Bill don't get involved. The interesting thing about the post office is, because you go back 350 years when it was first set up, it effectively ran its own police force. It was set up with armed guards, first of all, and then a really heavy-duty investigation branch. So it's always conducted its own investigations and its own prosecutions.
So the police didn't get involved, neither did the Crown Prosecution Service.
Sorry, so who is the post office is bringing these prosecutions completely without oversight?
And also, there are some sub-postmasters who are so concerned by the investigations against them that they asked the police to come in, and the post office said no, and the police said no, we can't, because the post office has authority.
But I think one of the most shocking things of what's been going on over the last 20 years is that there hasn't been any scrutiny or oversight of the post office's prosecution function. As far as I can make out, neither the Ministry of Justice, the National Audit Office, or anyone who is qualified to do so, the CPS themselves, have not reviewed the post office's ability to prosecute sub-postmasters and the rate at which they were doing it in the bad old days. Because there were dozens of prosecutions, criminal prosecutions every year.
So I'm not going to say when did the old Bill get involved. No, we know they didn't, nor did the Crown Prosecution Service. When did the prosecution start? Was it quickly after the installation of Horizon?
Oh, yeah, I spoke to a chap who went to prison in 2001, a 19-year-old kid who was working behind the counter of a Crown post office. Her counter was out of whack. She was sent to prison. This was in... She eventually went down in 2000, but she was picked up... 2002, but she was picked up in 2000, and then the court process obviously takes a period of months.
And what exactly are the charges? Is it fraud in general? Is it specific?
Fraud is one of them. False accounting is another one.
Well, the interesting thing about the way that the prosecutions happen is, and why so many sub-postmasters pleaded guilty, is that they were confronted with charges of theft and false accounting. And, you know, a rule of thumb really was that theft would get you sent to prison. False accounting would not. So many people agreed to plead guilty to false accounting in order not to go to prison, even though they were guilty of neither.
And once the post office had the conviction, they could then go after that sub-postmaster's assets under the Proceeds of Crime Act.
Right, so this is the missing £495 in the till, is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could be 49,000, more than 495, but yeah.
That much?
Oh, gosh, yeah. No, there was six-figure discrepancies.
What would happen is the discrepancies would build up, because people would first encounter a discrepancy, and then they would know that they were strictly liable for it. They would also hope that it would sort itself out. So they would claim that they were okay for a bit, thinking this might sort itself out. So technically, some of these people were guilty of false accounting.
Right.
simply in order to keep their business going.
Although I do maintain there has to be criminal intent, and I don't think there was criminal intent in a lot of this. But, you know, because they weren't there to dishonestly deprive people of money. They were just trying to keep their business going. I mean, if I spell out the false accounting trap to you, because it's the one thing that a lot of people say, well, why did they plead guilty if they were innocent? If you go 400 quid down, you call up the helpline, they can't help you out. The post office says, right, that's 400 quid. So the next time you go 800 quid down, you know what the helpline are going to be no use. You know that you're going to be held liable for that 800 quid. You tell them about it and they say, okay, we'll take it out of your salary if you can't afford it. Next time you go 2 grand down, you can't afford to have it taken out of your salary. You can't roll over your branch accounts to start trading the next day unless you agree the figures that are on the Horizon computer screen.
Right.
You are now potentially in danger of being held liable for whatever figure comes up on the screen. You could lose your investment in the business because the post office can just remove your job just like that, no matter how much money you spent on it and no matter how much money you spent on getting the retail premises up so that the footfall comes in. So some people in a desperate situation with just knowing that they were going to be held liable for something they didn't know how it had come about, would press the button on the screen and say, yeah, that is what is in my branch account,
right,
which the post office held them up as being false accounting. Now, in the recent High Court litigation, the judge said that there is no way under the terms of the contract that what they were doing was stating a settled account. Because if they raised hell with the helpline beforehand, if they'd said, look, we don't know how this is happening, then there is no way that them pressing that button on that computer screen could be a settled account, which is why so many cases are now with the Criminal Cases Review Commission.
Okay, so these prosecutions are now ongoing. At what point does it start becoming really clear that something is awry?
Nick mentioned Alan Bates, the first guy who sort of corralled a few sub-postmasters into action.
This is about 30 of them in Wales, did you say, a lot of them working?
Well, actually, the first meeting of the Justice for Sub-Postmasters Alliance was on the 8th of November 2010 in a village hall in Fenny Compton, where after sort of finding out how many people around the country appeared to be affected by this, he chose the most central location he could and had their first meeting.
So this is good postal efficiency in operation in this campaign. Very nice.
Yeah.
And what happened next?
This eventually grabbed the attention of MPs, which it, you know, should have done long before that, really. And they started asking some difficult questions. You know, what's going on? They brought in the chief executive of the post office into Parliament and said, you know, there are some questions to ask. And from there, they set up a proper investigation process, as they saw it, followed by a mediation process to try to iron out what these problems were. And it was really in that process that it became clear just how bad things were across the board.
And the post office response to that was to shut down the mediation scheme. Yeah.
And also
not offer any meaningful compensation, particularly to the people who'd been prosecuted.
And also, interestingly, from that point on, the prosecution stopped. I mean, we published the figures at some point. The one year there were 40-odd prosecutions. The next year there were 2.
Right.
And then 0. Because they realised that the prosecution process was absolutely fatally flawed.
At this point, they have realised that something's gone really wrong, but they are not making compensation and they're certainly not looking to overturn any of their convictions. Whether they can even do that, I don't know. I mean, they seem to have their own prosecutorial powers.
Yeah, I mean, they're actually denying there's anything wrong.
Yeah.
Even though their own actions, the fact that they will no longer pursue prosecutions based on this evidence, demonstrates that they know it's wrong.
Yeah.
They claim it's not. So every step of the way, they deny that there are problems with the Horizon IT system.
Right.
When we first wrote about this in September 2011, the next week we got a letter from the chief operating officer of the post office saying, no, this system is totally robust, totally reliable. They knew full well it wasn't, but it was a real head in the sand approach.
And we've now seen internal memos where the post office were discussing serious Horizon errors with Fujitsu. At the same time, the chief architect of Horizon was giving evidence for the post office against Seema Misra in court same month without raising any of the issues that were being discussed internally.
Wow. That's really extraordinary.
This has been described as one of the most widespread, or likely the most widespread, miscarriage of justice in the UK this century, and it's only just coming to light.
I think also people think, oh, it's the cuddly old post office. Mm. There's a real sense of whatever it might be, national pride or national indulgence, or whatever
it
is.
But it's it may appear that way, and at the centre of communities. I mean, some of these people are very genial, you know, good people. The sub-postmasters are doing a genuinely good job by and large, but at the heart in Post Office HQ, it's a different matter. It's an extremely authoritarian regime. It's not just, you know, in this context. Histories of the Post Office talk about how dissent is not tolerated. That has its roots in the history of the place, that it always had to be extreme control because, you know, there was espionage and theft from the king's mail and so on that had to be really clamped down on. So they were always an extremely authoritarian institution.
But in
and
Latin,
that was the approach that...
But when that, it mutated...
That was really the approach that governed exactly how they dealt with the scandal.
And when it mutated into a commercial organisation, it became about protecting the brand, and they were quite happy to throw entire livelihoods, lives and people's liberty under a bus in order to protect the brand. And there ought to be a special circle of hell reserved for the National Federation of Sub-Postmasters, the Sub-Postmaster Union,
okay,
who took a policy decision that they were not going to cause a ruckus about problems with Horizon because they didn't want to affect the business that the Post Office was doing with its clients, Bank of Ireland, DWP, DVLA, BBC through the licence fee, etc. And also because they wanted to maintain the sell-on value of the individual businesses.
Right.
Because if people had lost faith in the Horizon system that was at the centre of a branch post office, it reduces the value. So when sub-postmasters went to the National Federation, or the Fed as it's known, looking for help because they had discrepancies and because the post office were bearing down on them and trying to get money out of them and they couldn't understand why, the Fed's policy approach was to say, well, you know, well, there's nothing wrong with the computer, so, you know, maybe it's your staff who are thieving from you, you know. Wow. How are you going to pay it back?
That union is especially important, considering that you are classified as self-employed, you have no holiday entitlement, no sick pay, no pension entitlement. They're vital if you're a sub-postmaster.
Yeah. All the while this is going on, the conditions for sub-postmasters are getting tougher and tougher. At the same time as these prosecutions and you know, the refusal to deal with the injustices, there is this network transformation program which is closing sub-post offices.
Okay.
It's reducing the income that sub-postmasters automatically get from the post office and making them increasingly reliant on, you know, selling bank products for the Bank of Ireland generally, and from, you know, profitably running their shops. So the conditions are getting a lot worse. They're having to work much longer hours, and effectively the post office network, the sub-post office network, is getting squeezed in order to provide profit for the post office centrally.
And the biggest advocates for network transformation were the National Federation of Sub-Postmasters, who'd just been thrown out of the trades union movement for not being a proper union, and were negotiating with the post office for a annualised fee which would allow them to continue existing. And there is a memo from the General Secretary, which came up through the recent litigation, a memo from the General Secretary saying that he would not start to discuss this network transformation scheme in a positive light with his members until his organisation's future has been secured. And the judge in the recent litigation just found that the NFSP put its own interests above its members.
So that brings us on quite neatly to the most recent litigation. What has the verdict been after all these years of campaigning, all these lawsuits?
The post office lost big time. There were essentially two trials that went ahead. One was on the terms and the conditions and the way they dealt with sub-postmasters. And they were found to have treated them oppressively, have unfair contracts, and, you know, just to have behaved appallingly, really, towards sub-postmasters. The second trial that went ahead related specifically to the computer system, the Horizon system, and it found that, contrary to what the post office has been saying for years, there were serious bugs. They kept cropping up, that it covered them up, Fujitsu covered them up. And all this was known about internally, almost certainly played a part in the you know, the injustices, the prosecutions, the sackings and so on that sub-postmasters suffered.
The problem is with this is that the postmasters got a 58 million quid settlement. There were 550 claimants, and Therium, the litigation funders, who admittedly put a huge amount of money, tens of millions of quid on the line in order to try and win this litigation, take a massive success fee out of that
right.
final settlement total. The sub-postmasters who haven't yet received any compensation have been told that they can expect to share 10 million quid between them, which averages out at around 20 grand each. Which, when you think about some people who put 200 grand into a business, were held liable for six, four, five-figure discrepancies, who were also prosecuted, lost their reputation, suffered extraordinary mental health privations as well.
Went to prison.
That's obviously a separate criminal process. So that's they're still with the Criminal Cases Review
Those
Commission.
Those are ongoing.
But aside from the criminal sense, even people who were never prosecuted or who were never criminalised still suffered appalling mistreatment. And I don't think 18 or 19 grand is likely to cover what they've been through. So I think the post office got away with it. And the reason they did was because the costs of the trial, the litigation, were getting so high that there would come a point whereby it didn't matter how much they won in damages, even if they saw this litigation through, the costs would outweigh them. And so there's a real problem there, which hasn't, I don't think, been properly resolved.
Are the people who got away with it in particular, are the people who ran the post office throughout this period. The chief executive from 2012 was Paula Venables. She was the one leading this campaign of denial and the terrible obstruction of the attempted obstruction of the sort of fair judicial process. And over the period she's been chief executive, her pay has gone up something like 60-70%.
Now,
she's had huge bonuses, and huge bonuses driven by the financial results of the post office. So we had an executive board of the post office that was almost entirely incentivized to increase the profits of the post office in order to reduce the subsidy that the government was giving it. When your pay is determined in that way, it kind of influences how you behave. So
she left last year. There
would have been massive, there would have been massive financial consequences if they'd admitted problems with Horizon. She didn't want those massive financial consequences because it would have fed through into her pay packet.
Well, now I do want to put clearly on the record, as the magazine covered in November last year, that due to all of this, the short-term incentive payment paid to Paula Venables was cut by 20%, which was around £36,000. Now, it also does happen that her long-term incentive payment was increased by £50,000. But nonetheless, I think that is a very, I think she'll have learned her lesson there.
Yeah, she took a mere £14,000 increase or something like that.
Well, her total haul for the year was £718,000.
Yeah, and back when she started, it was something like £400,000. So she's done very well out of this period in which the post office has been ripped apart, really.
And there is a degree to which she is specifically culpable, because when she was preparing for the Select Committee hearing into what was going on with Horizon back in 2015, she sent a memo round saying, is remote access to these branch accounts possible? I need to say it's not. Which meant that she was directing her staff to say something which the post office had, a line the post office had stuck to assiduously, that there was no remote access to branch accounts, because that's how you prosecute someone, by saying you're the only one that can possibly be responsible for these accounts. Until the litigation in 2017, when they turned around in court and said, that's not true. You can access branch accounts remotely. Sorry about that, everyone.
So they could have seen these errors happening, and they could have...
They regularly did. We've spoken to a Fujitsu whistleblower who said that part of his job back in the day was to go climb into sub-postmasters' branch accounts remotely and fix whatever bug was causing a problem. And they denied that until 2017.
It's really kind of beyond belief.
Yeah, I mean, it looks really like a corrupt organisation. And the people at the top, I mean, you look at where they are now. It's really instructive to have a look at them. Paula Venables is now on a board at the Cabinet Office, at the heart of Whitehall. She's also chair of an NHS, a major NHS foundation trust, Imperial. The chairman who oversaw this kind of culture of injustice, Tim Parker, he's actually chair of Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunals Service, would you believe? And the National Trust and various other positions. So these people just go from strength to strength. And that's without getting on to the ministers who just let the post office become a law unto itself.
That lack of scrutiny and oversight, I think, is unforgivable, because successive postal services or post office ministers refused to intervene. They didn't want to poke any hornet's nest. And the line that they were sold by the post office, they regurgitated in Parliament whenever backbench MPs were jumping up and down about the issue. And it's almost negligent the way that they behaved, because they just couldn't be bothered. They just let them get on with it. They were too busy with trying to make the post office wash its face to actually look at the concerns that major miscarriages of justice may have taken place. Just one note about the litigation. When it concluded after the settlement, we were due this Horizon judgment, the second trial judgment, which came down. And the judge, unbeknownst to anyone in the courtroom, including the lawyers, said, right, well, that's the trial settled. I just want to make you aware that I've been so concerned by the evidence that has been given by Fujitsu employees over the course of this litigation and in previous criminal and civil trials, that he was handing a folder to the Director of Public Prosecutions with a view to him potentially looking at possible prosecutions of Fujitsu employees going forward.
Well, that actually leads to my last question, which is what comes next? So we know that's one potential consequence.
Yeah, I think there are three things. There's the potential parliamentary inquiry. There is a big push for that. Jill Furness, MP, who's the Shadow Postal Services Minister, earlier this week demanded one of the government. Lord Arbuthnot, formerly James Arbuthnot of North East Hampshire MP, he says there needs to be a judge-led inquiry. You've got the potential DPP getting involved with what the judge in the trial has given him. And you've also got the Criminal Cases Review Commission, who are looking at the cohort of criminalised sub-postmasters. And they've been sitting on these for 5 years now. And they've got to make a decision pretty soon as to whether or not they are going to refer those 35 sub-postmasters' cases to the Court of Appeal.
And I think all that is without what you really need, which is some political accountability and some accountability from the board of the post office. And the government hasn't been held accountable. Whenever it's been asked about this scandal, it's just said, well, that's not really anything to do with us. That's a management issue for the post office. Well, you know, there comes a point when people are being wrongly sent to jail at a publicly owned institution where perhaps the government ought to sit up. And I think there are lots of questions about why they didn't, why successive ministers have just treated the post office as a sort of cash machine rather than a public service with real people at the heart of it.
Richard Brooks there. Thanks to him and Nick Wallace for their time, and that special report that they are writing will be running in the magazine soon. Now, we turn to matters of extreme, very grave importance. I'm talking, of course, about the royal family and about the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Their capers, escapades, call them what you will, have been covered in the magazine, as have many other royal issues, by the magazine's extremely secretive correspondent known only as Flunky. Flunky is incredibly highly placed. I'm not going to confirm or deny whether Flunky is actually the Queen, but Flunky's work is dealt with in the magazine by iHack Adam McQueen. I started off by asking, just to make absolutely sure, is Adam McQueen Flunky?
I am not Flunky. No, I am not.
Okay.
But I do, I guess you could say I'm Flunky's handler at Private Eye. Essentially, he or she write their thoughts on what's been going on in the royal household on a piece of vellum, obviously, which they then roll up and insert into a corgi, which I then go down and meet in St. James's Park and extract it and put it in the magazine.
So this is one of the interesting things about royal coverage, and it's one of the ways in which other organs are perhaps quite similar to the eye, is that Flunky is not named, and so too other royal sources are not named in most papers. And this is kind of de rigueur for royal correspondence.
Yeah, I mean, it works in a lot of ways. There's the kind of royal rota, and the royal circuit of official accredited royal correspondence works quite similarly in a way to the parliamentary lobby. So a lot of it, you know, there are sort of official briefings that people are called to, and then they pass on that kind of thing. And there is, in the same way as there is with the parliamentary lobby, a sort of understanding that it works two ways, and that you're not going to embarrass your sources or official people in the royal household too much in return for the sort of access that you'll give them on their terms. And that's what doesn't happen with Private Eye, because we are entirely round the back of the palace, near the bins, picking up gossip entirely on our own terms with no quid pro quo whatsoever.
I mean, it's one of the relationships at the Mag where I guess trust is very important, because you're taking everything and you are putting it in the magazine and you are the handler, but really Flunky is the person who is on the ground, as you say, by the bins.
There is an element with, it happens with a lot of stories at Private Eye and a lot of people, where you do end up taking stuff on trust simply because people have got such a fantastic record on it. And Flunky has been right there months ahead of the rest of the Royal Pack with an awful lot of Royal exclusives and, you know, clearly knows their stuff.
So this is one of the interesting things. The Sun made a lot of capital about how they had got the scoop about Meghan and Harry stepping back. This had actually kind of already been in Private Eye a while ago.
Yeah, well, Flunky has been discussing exactly what's going to go on with Meghan and Harry for a lot over the last year, and actually explicitly said in November that this was coming up. At that point, he or she wasn't sure how permanent a move it would be. At that point, there were talks or thoughts that it would only be perhaps a year off. They took that 6-week sabbatical in Canada in the run-up to Christmas. And certainly, Flunky was saying at that point, it looked as if a more long-term departure was on the cards. It turned out to be an absolutely permanent one, which, I mean, it looks now as if that wasn't necessarily as permanent a severing as ended up being the case. That was sort of being forced upon them with the negotiations that then went on at Sandringham and elsewhere over the last few weeks, of which there is an extremely good account in the new edition of Private Eye.
And in fact, I think the Eye was the first to name it, just to do a bit more of an I told you so, except it was originally called Sussexit.
Sussexit or Sexit. Yes, yeah. I have to say, I do think Megxit is a bit better. It kind of trips off the tongue better, doesn't it?
I think Sexit is a better thing to shout out if you're annoyed. Oh, Sexit.
Sexit probably applies more to, it's bringing to mind that hacked phone call of Prince Charles's where he was telling Camilla exactly what intimate relationship he would like to have with her. Younger listeners might like to Google Camilla Gate or just Prince Charles and tampon if they want to know what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. The amazing thing about the dispatches from Flunky is how far they get into how many different areas of royal life, because there are a lot of areas. So, for example, one of the recent reports a couple of months ago was all about the prime ministerial briefings and how annoyed the Queen had been at the constitutional shenanigans over Brexit leading up to the election.
That is one place Flunky has not been, because no one has been. No one ever. We're left with Peter Morgan attempting to imagine what actually goes on in that room between Brenda and any one of her prime ministers. What Flunky did bring in was a lot of the worry and the fretting that was going on elsewhere in the royal household, very high up in the royal household, about what they were hearing on their side of, from those briefings and the serious worries that the Queen does have about how to handle Boris and the difficulties she has with him, because he doesn't behave apparently in quite the same way as a lot of her prime ministers have done beforehand.
So one of the things that regular readers of the column will note is that the Queen is Brenda and Prince Charles is Brian. Why is that?
Well, this is a long-standing Private Eye convention, which originated back in, I think, the 70s, in the Grovel column, which was a very weird and un-Private Eye-ish, it seems now, sort of column, written largely by Nigel Dempster at the time. But that, like Flunky stuff these days, came directly from the royal household. It was how the servants below stairs referred to them. It was the nicknames they gave them. And there was, in fact, a full set, though a lot of them have fallen into disuse. Well, they largely fall into disuse because the people concerned fell into disuse. So Princess Margaret was Yvonne, and Princess Diana, when she first joined the royal household, was referred to as Cheryl, which is rather fantastic. The one that Flunky revealed a couple of years ago, which doesn't seem to caught on, which is a shame because I think it's brilliant, and it hasn't caught on largely because Harry and Meghan can be referred to as H&M after the shop, which also works quite well. But apparently courtiers were referring to them as Monica and Chandler, as in Friends, and specifically as in the geeky man who can't quite believe his luck at pulling Courtney Cox, which I thought was a rather lovely one.
If you were pushed, which would you say is a more gossipy environment? Either Fleet Street, which obviously you know a huge amount about because you write so much of the Street of Shame, or the royal circles where Flunky is getting their material?
I would have to say Fleet Street is more gossipy, but royal circles, the gossip is more accurate in my experience. Things I am told tend to turn out to be true in a way which they don't always. There is a weird thing with journalists telling stories about themselves in that they cannot resist embellishing, improving the story, kind of putting a decent headline on it and bumping up an intro on it. So it gets the story you sometimes get is a better version of the truth. Whereas with flunky stuff, I'm fairly sure that it's bang on.
Adam McQueen there. Now, Flunky is the correspondent who deals with the day-in, day-out business of the royal family and, as I said, their capers and escapades. But the royal family obviously appears throughout the pages of Private Eye, particularly in the joke pages and on the covers. I spoke to Ian Hislop and Nick Newman about the magazine's general attitude to royalty, and I started off by asking Ian what, in the opinion of the magazine itself, is the function of a modern royal family.
I think probably one of the main constitution roles of a royal family is to provide comic material for Private Eye. And, I mean, Nick says we don't repeat the jokes about the royal family. I think, in a sense, that's what we should do, because it's comforting. It's like the royal family itself. It's always the same joke. It gives a feeling of continuity.
In a changing world.
In a changing world, the jokes are very much the same. I mean, we did run, when Meghan was about to marry Harry, we ran just a very small piece with a picture of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor saying, Prince marries American divorcee, followed by another picture of Harry and Meghan saying, Prince marries American divorcee. I mean, what could go wrong? Yes, and in the end, I mean, because Private Eye has spent at least 50 years making jokes about the royal family waving. We once did a cover which was just entirely pictures of the Queen waving.
Oh, yeah, that was how her role has changed. Yes. It was a Diamond Jubilee, and it was 1950s, 60s, 70s, exactly the same thing every time.
So we couldn't resist putting the cover on this one, which is just Harry explaining to Meghan that the entire job of the royal family is to wave, and she doesn't quite get it and just waves goodbye.
Do you get twitchy ever about putting the Queen on the cover?
It does lead to a lot of complaints. We got a huge number of complaints when there was a sort of 21-gun salute or something like that for on the cover for the Queen's Jubilee or something like that. And Prince Charles is sort of pointing the guns and saying the Queen's over there sort of thing. And, you know, people don't like the idea that Charles is a monarch in waiting and that he might have designs on the throne himself in a sort of Shakespearean way. But
yes, you say people don't like the idea. I do like that idea, which is why...
Again, it's all down to tradition, isn't it?
Essentially, you do get the same joke. And that brings us to Sylvie Crynne, which is...
Yes.
The Eye has a resident romantic novelist to cover the royal family. I mean, this was not my invention. This was Ingram's and Fantoni, which is their brilliant idea that the royal family should be covered only in gushing, overblown, romantic, fictional vocabulary. And they invented this novelist called Sylvie Crynne. But in recent years, essentially, Sylvie covers a series of events with Charles... mistakenly imagining that he's about to have become king. And again, some people do think that's a bit mean, but with a hereditary royal family, that's all there is.
There was a bit of a sea change last year when we suddenly thought, well, actually, with the looming disaster that was going to be Brexit and all the Operation Brown Trouser and things like that, which were detailing how we were all going to be eating rats within a week, that Prince Charles may have thought that actually he doesn't want to take over. So there was a slight change of tone in that he was desperately trying to keep the Queen alive and prevent her from facing a disaster in the hope that he would sort of escape having to sort of bear this this princely burden of the nightmare scenario.
But there have been so many nightmare scenarios since then that I'm afraid he is going to have to take over.
Brexit is the very least of his worries and the monarchy's worries.
when I see Sylvie Crin, I think, I cannot possibly imagine the news story that has led to Charles thinking he's going to be king this week. It's, you know, if... what's a good example of a Sylvie Crin misunderstanding?
Well, the emperor in Japan decides to abdicate in favour of a younger man.
And he hears the radio and he hears it's going to be an abdication.
When June Whitfield died and she was the queen of comedy. I heard that on the radio. The queen of comedy has died. And I thought immediately, oh, yes, that's Charles listening in the bath.
He's always in the bath as well. It's always
Barbara Windsor went. Another distinguished older matriarch Windsor figure goes. I'm afraid, you know, there are a lot of variations to what might have him leaping out the bath shouting Carolus Rex vivat myself.
Yeah, you're right. He does seem to spend an inordinate long period of time in the bath, and it's always a sort of a classic sort of Edwardian bath, like a White House and Mortimer bath, or they're based in Bath, aren't they? Ironically,
I think they are. They're sort of Fry and Laurie baths, and
but that's the other
Fig and Fielding.
They're always brand names. I mean, that's the thing about Sylvie Crin is because these, you know, romantic novels, they have a lot of brand names in them.
They do. Lifestyle. I mean, if you just read, you know, Jilly Cooper and of course the great Geoffrey Archer, they're just cram full of stuff to show that they've read the glossy magazines and the luxury item supplement in the FT. Just, you know, it's a shorthand way of creating the world in which they live. But our brand names are never quite the same as Archer's.
Yes, I mean, it's brand names and geography. You've got to show, as a novelist, that you really know your terrain. And for us, that's usually Scotland. So that means Charles walking up Ben Elton and through Glenmorangie. And these are important sort of guides to his state of mind. It's sort of novelist topography. It's very, very important.
So the other thing to talk about in terms of how the gag pages write about the royals is the Nursery Times, because this is, you know, a way of writing about the Frogmore Prince or whatever it might be, or the grand, not so grand old Duke of York, whatever it is.
Yeah, the Nursery Times is a very good way of dealing sometimes with quite difficult subjects in a very, very silly, sideways way. It isn't always royals. We've done Pedo Pan and stories like that.
Nothing in poor taste.
Nothing in very bad taste, but it is a way of doing that sort of right, slightly awkward story. But for the royals, no, it's a gift.
And I think if Sylvie Crin, the premise is that the royal family is a romantic novel in Nursery Times, which Nick and I started up, I mean, it's even more blatant. It's just saying the royal family is a fairy tale. Everyone talks about fairy tale princesses. Every time it goes wrong, everyone says, but it's not a fairy tale, having told everyone it was a fairy tale. So we just do the fairy tales. So we have Prince Charmless and whichever one it is, and his brother Prince Charming, whichever one, you know, the media has decided is charming this week or isn't. And then we do the princess, and we do the princess, and we do the Frogmore Prince, and we do the lily pad, which is very expensive to renovate, but they're paying it back now. So it is a good way of reiterating that there are a couple of stories going on here.
And also, I think the other interesting thing, just relating it to fairy tales, is that, you know, like, you know, in stories there are only seven different plots or whatever it is, the royal stories tend to sort of echo what happened in fairy tales all the time. So there's a lot of jealousy and a rivalry between the ugly sisters, and all that kind of thing is sort of echoed throughout the real royal stories.
Well, this is the other thing, because it deals with the way the royals are covered, and you can't really split up the royals from the insane, obsequious coverage they get. So there was a gag that you were telling me about, Nick, before we started recording, which was dealing with Meghan's wedding day. And this was at the time of Meghan and Harry's wedding.
Well, we'd sort of begun to pick up on the fact that the Daily Mail had become completely schizophrenic about the whole attitude to the royals. And you get, on the one hand, the puffing up, and then a couple of pages later, the complete hatchet job that would follow often by one of the columnists like Sarah Vane. But we just sort of basically did a bit of observation.
And we just put together the headline. So you'd get on one page, "Marvellous Meghan is royal breath of fresh air."
And then page two, "Pushy starlet turns hallowed traditions on its heads."
"Magnificent Markle transforms royal style."
"Wannabe actress flaunts red carpet flesh."
And it goes on.
"Caring Kate loses a brother-in-law but gains a sister."
"Minxie Meg crashes royal inner circle in her dreams." And it ends up with, "Joyous wedding preparations begin."
"We prepare to dig up dirt and put the boot in."
And actually at the wedding, we had a picture of them at the wedding with someone saying, "How long's the honeymoon?" And someone saying, "Just until the tabloids turn on you." So again, I think no one should have been surprised that the coverage of Meghan and Harry went from utterly sycophantic to utterly poisonous. I mean, that is how the tabloids work. The trouble with the press coverage of the royal family, which is why we find it very funny, is that it tends to have its own agenda. So this issue, we ran a piece with a picture of Meghan and a picture of Kate, and it was the Mail on Sunday, and it said, "Style guide, what's the difference between brilliant, graceful, elegant, selfless Kate and brash, gauche, misguided, selfish Meghan?" The answer, one of them's suing the Mail on Sunday and the other one isn't. You know, obviously we should set up as a PR firm, but even we've noticed that as a tactic. Suing all the tabloids and then worrying that they're not going to cover you generously.
Yeah, it's not a great idea, I would think.
And so in terms of Private Eye's coverage of royal matters, or Private Eye's relationship with the royal family, which I imagine is not an especially close one, do you ever get letters? Do you ever get, you know, notifications from courtiers saying, "That's a bit much"?
No, we occasionally hear on the grapevine, because I do believe that Private Eye is occasionally incorporated in the cuttings that are sent to Her Majesty. And there have been indications that one or two of the jokes have actually, unlike Queen Victoria, have actually amused the Queen. I think there was, if you remember, there was a petition which a lot of people signed, saying, "Could Mr. Trump not come and have a royal visit?" And we found a picture of the Queen signing a great book and just pretended that was it, which I gather.
Yes,
I
mean, it was reported to us that found its way into the Queen's special scrapbook of favourite items in the press.
But with all royal stories, you have to be careful because, again, most of the joke pages are full of royal correspondents making it up because they don't tend to know very much.
And also you personally have to be very careful because you're after a knighthood, aren't you?
I am. And it's been incredibly slow coming. I watch year after year as the Queen's honours list comes forwards with people I think who've done less, really, for the royal family. And there I am, not again.
The cruelly overlooked Ian Hislop and Nick Newman there. Thanks very much to both of them. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again next month. Look out for us at the end of February. Until then, the magazine is available in all good newsagents and the subscription deals are out of this world. Do check it out. Thanks very much for listening. See you then. Goodbye.